American Affairs Bureau, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Safety Bureau, Nakajima. Mrs. Takeshi Yasukawa. Former Ambassador to the United States and Honorary Vice President of the American Defense Society, Mr. Nobuhiko Fushiba. Mrs. William C. Sherman. The former Justice Supreme Court of Japan and Honorary Vice President of our society, Mr. Takeso Shimoda. Mrs. Shinsaku Hogan. Former Ambassador to the United States and Honorary Vice President of the Society, Mr. Ryuji Takeuchi. Mrs. George G. Loving, Jr. Member of the House of Representatives and former Speaker of the House, Mr. Naka Tanada. The wife of the Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs of the Foreign Ministry, Mrs. Bunroku Yoshino. Now I switch to this side of the table. Former Ambassador to the United States and Honorary Vice President of the Society, Mr. Takeshi Yasukawa. Mrs. Toshijiro Nakajima. The former Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs and now President of the Japan International Cooperation Agency, Mr. Shinsaku Hogan. Mrs. Nobuhiko Fushiba. The Minister of the United States Embassy, Mr. William C. Sherman. Mrs. Takeso Shimoda. The Commander of the United States Forces in Japan and of the 5th Air Force, Lieutenant General George G. Loving. Mrs. Ryuji Takeuchi. The former Minister of Education and former Speaker of the House, Mr. Takechio Matsuda. And with special pleasure, may I present Mrs. Mike Mansky. I would now like to turn our proceedings over to President Kishi.
Our Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we are foregathered here to extend our welcome to the Ambassador of the United States and Mrs. Mansky at this table to extend our welcome, Mr. Ambassador and Mrs. Mansky. It is a great honor for us to have your company at this meeting with us today.
Mansfield 大使のご一列につきましては、すでに周知されておるところでありますので、改めてここにご紹介申し上げるまでもありませんが、恒例により簡単に申し上げます。大使は、モンタナ大学ご卒業後、1933年から43年まで、母校においてラテンアメリカ及び極東に関する歴史学教授となられました後に、1942年から下院議員に 選ばれましたが、1952年から1977年に至るまで上院議員に選出せられ、ことに1961年以来、今日に至るまで引き続きマジョリティリーダーとしてご活躍になられましたことは皆様ご承知のとおりであります。
I realize that it is hardly necessary for me to present the career of the great guest of honor, for his eminent position is well known to us all. But allow me to follow the usual procedure of the meeting and recite briefly the highlights of his career. Mr. Mansfield, after graduating,from the University of Montana, for a long period of 10 years, from 1933 to 1943, he was a professor of Latin America and Far Eastern history at his alma mater. Mr. Mansfield was elected to the Congresses for a long period extending from 1942 to 1952, and since 1961 he served as minority leader of the Senate through 1977. Was a great debt of gratitude to the United States, not only for the opening of Japanby Commander Perry, but for the rehabilitation of the country after the last war. We were enabled then to rebuild and make great strides in the manufacturing industry, economy, and expanding trade. Happily, as a result, the United States and Japan have become the largest trade partners. While we are not unmindful of the existence of difficult issues arising in the commercial intercourse, I hope confrontations be avoided and appropriate settlement be reached by dialogue conducted in the spirit of mutuality and interdependence.
さらに我が国として最も重要なる問題に国防の問題がございました。ご承知の通り、日米両国間にはいわゆる安保条約が存在をしておりまして、我が国の安全はこれによって保障されております。太平洋並びに極東全般にわたって国際的に幾多の不安がなしとせぬ現状におきましては、いろいろこの問題に関して日米の協力の問題がございます。
Then another issue uppermost in our mind at present is the defense position of the country. While we feel at ease under the US-JapanSecurity treaty. But it is undeniable that there are some difficult presence in this part of the world, and especially the presence of uncertainty and uneasiness felt for the maintenance of peace.In the Far East and the Pacific area at large.
こうした重要なる時期におきまして、米国政界に重きをなし、政治的経験が極めて豊かな、このマンスフィールド大使閣下を駐日大使として迎えましたことは、我々一同の最も。
We are very fortunate to have a man of great ability, experience, and resources in the person of the American ambassador in Tokyo. Here at this meeting, we all members of the society are happy to extend to you all our hearty welcome.
それでは、マンスフィールド駐日米国大使閣下をご紹介申し上げます。
It's a great pleasure, honor to present His Excellency, Ambassador Mansfield.
Because the best forestry school in the United States just happens to be at the University of Montana. And he talked so much about his son that he forgot to give me his name. So if, after we get through, you will do me the honor, I will be most happy to write him a letter of commendation and congratulation. I will speak briefly and I will also speak quietly. Quietly, because I hope and believe that we are entering a new era in the relations between Japan and the United States. An era characterized by quiet, constructive diplomacy in which both nations can reap the harvest of many years we have spent learning from and about each other. Today I want to talk to you about certain things which I believe are vitally important to both of us. The American-Japan Society has always been a rather special forum dedicated to promoting a better understanding of our two countries, our cultures, our aspirations, and our respective points of view. It has sought to achieve this understanding through rational discussion, free of emotional rhetoric. In a quiet and effective way, we have attempted to examine problems together. We have had differences at times in the past, but in resolving them, we tried first to understand each other's basic assumptions. It is this effort to listen to each other's point of view and to concentrate on expanding the area of agreement that has helped to make our bilateral relationship so very special. Since my arrival in Japan last June, I have thought a great deal about this unique relationship of ours and its significance in this time of increasingly multilateral rather than just bilateral communication. The U.S.-Japan relationship grows daily more intense and more complex in a way that is healthy, but also accompanied by increasing risks of disagreement, misjudgment, misunderstanding and crisis. And yet, in terms of public perceptions and reactions to the intricate problems of our relationship, we are experiencing one of the greatest periods of quiet in our post-war history. I have come to Japan determined to do all I can to contribute to the continuing dialogue between us. The constructive, quiet, and peaceful and purposeful exchange of ideas, which I believe can be a model for our relationships in the late 20th century. I know of no other relationship quite like ours, and I believe there are important lessons to be learned from it, perhaps the most important being the intense desire on both sides to avoid the mistakes of the past, to listen, to resolve our differences in a quiet and orderly manner, and to arrive at understandings based on an honest exchange of views. During my 4 months in this country, I have been very impressed by the fine results that calm and deliberate negotiations can achieve. For example, for the past month, we have been engaged in a steady exchange of views at all levels on important trade issues. Our current trade difficulties are as serious as any with which we have been confronted in the past 30 years. But so far, they have not been accompanied by the stridency so often heard in the past. On the contrary, the recent visits here by Deputy Special Trade Commissioner Wolf, Secretary of the Treasury Blumenthal, Undersecretary of State Cooper, and Mr. Bergston, Secretary of Commerce Preps, and soon, hopefully, by Special Trade Representative Strauss, have seen nothing but quiet, professional discussions in an atmosphere of cooperation. Without fanfare, Japan has taken on a responsible role with respect to the multilateral trade negotiations in Geneva, and the formation of the U.S.-Japan Joint Economic Forecasting Committee and the Joint Trade Facilitations Committee are other examples of the diplomatic machinery which can help to maintain friendly relations between our two countries. So, we are learning how to make our bilateral relations produce a bit more life and much less heat. We see less now of the word escalation, which has so often plagued our relations in the past. When private requests become public demands, when question becomes rejected, when suggested becomes ordered, it can seriously hinder negotiations and cause confusion and lack of understanding on the part of the general public. Unfortunately, we will always see some of this, but the heat has been turned down as we both mature. In the past, a great deal has been said about the close ties of friendship between your country and mine. In describing relations between two countries, friendship has a very simple definition. It means that the leaders and citizens of each country care a great deal about what happens to the other. It means that they see distinct advantages to having compatible, non-antagonistic relationships with each other. It implies a readiness to compromise on short-term issues for the long-term period, the long-term good. It also implies a tolerance and a willingness to learn about each other's internal and external problems in detail so that these problems can be taken into account. It is an enterprise which requires the constant investment of new capital, mental and psychological capital, in the sense that we can never be content with what we have. It is a relationship in which we share the deep satisfaction of working our problems together, but which is too intimate to escape feeling great disappointment when we fail to do so. Since both of us are constantly changing, we can never stop talking and learning about each other. Friendship, bridging historical and cultural differences as great as those which exist between the United States and Japan, require a constant investment of time and effort, and an ability to listen and to learn about each other's changing needs. It is manifestly easier to communicate with and understand an ally with whom you have a common language and tradition. But it is essential to do whatever is necessary to keep channels of communication open and functioning with other allies, regardless of the difficulty. Neither nations nor individuals can exist without friends in today's world. Only about 100 years ago, there were still a few men in my native Montana
who lived alone in the wilderness and had almost no contact with other human beings. But even the legendary mountain men, Jim Bridger and Jedediah Smith, who once roamed the Montana wilderness, were dependent upon the rest of the world as a market for their furs and as a source for their rifles, ammunition, traps, and so forth. They knew, just as we know, that no nation, no human being can exist in a world alone. Because as John Donne has said so eloquently, no man is an island unto itself. It seems to me that by now virtually all people of the industrialized world realize how much we depend upon one another, regardless of the differences or similarities. In values or political systems, we are aware that we are essential to each other's well-being. Unfortunately, the differences sometimes are given the spotlight, exaggerated in importance, or taken out of context. That is when the broad context and willingness not only to talk, but to listen, can make a real difference in relations between countries, just as it can between individual human beings. During my long career as a legislator, I came to have a deep and abiding respect for the people and their sure and certain ability to see the best pathway if given the proper information and the time to think the matter through. These requirements are not always met. Japan is deluged with information about the United States. The daily flow of bits and pieces of information is overwhelming. The hard task is to sort out this data and create from it an accurate picture of the United States. This process is complicated by many apparent contradictions. America is a wealthy, stable nation, valuing free enterprise and equal opportunity. But it has high unemployment, lingering racial discrimination, and a high crime rate. The people of the United States do not receive nearly enough information about Japan. The image there also has contradictions. Many Americans still hold a mental image of 18th century Japan, which is difficult to reconcile with Japan's status as an economic superpower. If the image we form of each other is generally favorable, it takes a long series of disastrous mistakes to turn it into an unfavorable image. Faith and friendship between nations with long associations is not quickly eroded. Even during the worst days of the Vietnam War, most Japanese kept their faith in America. So-called shocks have caused temporary distortions, but they have not permanently damaged the fabric of our relationship. It would be difficult to overestimate the value of organizations like the American-Japan Society and meetings like the Shimoda Conference, and the myriad other forms of consultation in promoting dialogues which serve to help the individual make some sense out of the mass of contradictory data. Differences between us in tradition, custom, background, and perspective still have the potential for turning a minor problem into a very troublesome dispute. We have attempted to set up rather elaborate machinery to prevent this. We talk to each other constantly at all levels of both government and the private sector to ensure that misunderstandings are resolved as quickly as possible and with broad participation in the process. Both our countries vitally need healthy economies, not only for the sake of Japan and the United States, but in the interest of the rest of the world as well. In the last analysis, the quality of our life depends on the degree to which we can cooperate in organizing rationally our use of resources for today's world and for the world of our children and grandchildren. It is not a case of whether or not we agree on mutually advantageous goals. we simply must agree. Not only as two highly industrialized allies, but as members of the world family. I believe that we have entered an era in which we can begin to reap the benefits of our past experience. We, the United States and Japan, are already encountering challenges which make those of the past seem insignificant. Developing energy and other resources and finding enough food to feed the world's ever-growing population are problems, just to mention a few, which are much more serious and demanding of wisdom and cooperation than anything we have dealt with before. But I believe we are equal to the challenge. Our relationship is a true partnership, one no longer focused mainly on bilateral concerns, but more and more devoted to working constructively with all nations of the world. If you will bear with me, I would like to outline a concrete example to this maturing of our relationship and to give some indication of what it can mean for the rest of the world when we make the friendship and the machinery to maintain it for us. The Tokai-Mura Agreement resulted from an excellent example of quiet negotiations between equals on a most controversial issue. Both countries are very much aware of the dangers inherent in the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Japan applauded President Carter for committing in his inaugural address his administration to the long-term goal of eliminating nuclear weapons and for making efforts to reduce nuclear weapons levels and testing. The wide gap between U.S. and Japanese perspectives on the non-proliferation theme did not become apparent until after the Carter-Fukuda summit in March. Essentially, the Japanese view, as I understand it, was that against the dark future energy picture, the breeder reactor is essential, and the use of recycled plutonium in current reactors may be important to reduce resource requirements. The U.S. position was that the economics of recycling plutonium are uncertain, and alternative ways to obtain the energy from spent fuel must be explored now, before going further down the road. Both agreed that the danger of the availability of extracted plutonium for weapons must be decreased. In the nuclear non-proliferation bill sent to Congress in late April, the President made his position clear on the restriction of the transfer of nuclear materials and technology. With its three non-nuclear principles, and in view of its aversion to nuclear weapons and its lack of domestic fuel sources, Japan felt that such restrictions would not apply. Japan accordingly proceeded with plans to start up the Tokai-Mura facility on schedule. In an attempt to bring the positions closer together, a joint U.S.-Japan technical study of alternative ways to operate the facility was done in early July. Specialists from both sides developed a number of alternative plans for the policymakers of the two governments to consider. By the time this careful policy consideration was completed and the negotiators met again in Tokyo in early September, both sides had greatly improved their understanding of each other's basic concerns. By then it was evident to all more time would be needed to study improvements in nuclear fuel reprocessing cycles so that, as the Japanese have so well put it, non-proliferation safeguards could coexist with maximum use of nuclear fuel as an energy source. The result then was the agreement with which you all are familiar. The negotiations were protracted but never heeded. This was one area where the issue was of such great import that an excess of caution was a virtue. There were headlines day after day on the negotiations, but we were able, together, to prevent an issue of considerable national concern from becoming emotionally charged to the point that it damaged our relations. Ambassador Jerry Smith has said that the negotiations throughout were carried on from a position of equality. Concessions were made by both sides. While the Carter administration succeeded in carrying through its basic non-proliferation policy, Japan succeeded in safeguarding its investment in the Tokaimura facility. In the words of one editorial appearing in the Japanese press, it was, quote, the first example in the world of negotiations under President Carter's new policy of striving to strengthen nuclear non-proliferation, end quote. And that, quote, the U.S.-Japan negotiations would serve as a model to be applied to the rest of the world, unquote. It is indeed a model of successful negotiations between equal partners in which the basic objective of both sides was achieved. I feel that it may serve as a watershed for future negotiations on major issues. Let us hope that we can repeat the performance again and again. We can, if we have faith in our relationship, in our long experience together, and in the spirit of equality which now exists between our two great nations. Japan itself is largely responsible. There is no gainsaying the fact that its growth into its present position as the world's third largest economic power had a great deal to do with the new spirit of equality. For our part, the administration of President Carter has, on the first day in office, demonstrated a keen awareness of the vital importance of Japan, of the role Japan plays in the world, and of the even larger role it must play in the future, especially with relation to the developing countries of Asia. This atmosphere of equality and responsibility is one in which we can sit down together without always having an our side and your side. We are both on our side. In a real sense, we have moved the relationship well down the road toward the kind of consensus building process you have developed here in Japan into a fine art. It is through this process that we have time and again responded to what John Gardner of Common Cause has labeled incalculable opportunities disguised as insoluble problems. We have taken these problems and made them opportunities to talk rationally, to consult, to understand, and to build the machinery to solve similar problems that may occur in the future. Between two countries so large and so involved in world affairs, there will be no shortage of problems. It is up to us to make sure, very sure, that they are dealt with creatively and gently. In the Copper Mines of Montana, we have an expression which some of you have probably heard me use from time to time. The expression is Tapper Light. I am fond of the expression since it puts me, and I hope others, at ease. Perhaps it is even applicable to the theme of my talk here today. The miners use the term to caution others about sticks of dynamite. You drill the hole and then tap the sticks down into it. If you tap them a bit too hard, they might explode. Best to take it easy and tapper light. There are potentially explosive issues like those dynamite sticks all around us today. And we need to approach them gingerly and with concern for others here in Japan, the United States, and elsewhere in the world. We must keep these issues from reaching the explosive stage through intelligent and calm discourse. In closing, I would suggest to all of you and advise all of us that during these times we tap our light. Thank you very much.
しかったら、日米関係について極めて有益なお話を伺いまして、熱く感謝いたします。なお、この機会にご報告申し上げたいのでありますが、先般の日米協会の総会におきまして、全会一致でマンスフィールド大使を我が協会の名誉会長に推戴いたしまして、その就任方についてお願いを申し上げましたところ、大使のご快諾を得まして、我々は今後この新しい名誉会長のご指導のもとに、協会の目標